Welcome to the Real Education Podcast. I'm your host, Blake Bowles, and on this show, I interview remarkable people who think way outside the box in education. To listen to more episodes, learn more about my guests, or become a patron of this ad and sponsor-free show, visit blakebowles.com/podcast. You can also email me at yourstruly@blakebowles.com. Now, on to the show. My guest today is Will Richardson, a former public school educator of 22 years, a longtime education blogger, and the author of four books, most recently, Why School? How Education Must Change When Learning and Information Are Everywhere, which was based on his TEDx talk in Melbourne, Australia, and has become the number one best-selling TED book. Welcome to the podcast, Will.
Hey, thanks for having me, Blake. Appreciate it.
So your book, Why School?, totally blew me away. It's short, it's readable, it makes a really, I think the strongest case I've read for the positive role of technology in school and in education in general. And so we're going to get to questions about that, but I want you to start at the beginning and tell me how your teaching career began.
Well, I actually was a journalist out of college, and I worked for about 2 years doing that and had the opportunity to go back to school. I always had thought of education as something that I thought I wanted to do. I had some really great teachers who motivated me, which is pretty much the story of most teachers, you know, that they had influences in their lives that helped them learn in ways that were pretty compelling. So anyway, I went back to school, got my teaching certificate, and I started full-time somewhere long, long time ago now, back in like 1983, 84, which was a little bit before technology, obviously before the web, well before the web, but was working in a school that was pretty progressive even at that point with trying to get technology into classrooms. And I spent 22 years there. I spent 18 years as a classroom teacher. Toward the end of my teaching career, I started using a lot of social tools. I was one of probably the first people to bring blogs into the classroom, and did some writing about that. And that's kind of what got me noticed a little bit. Just being able to ask some, I think, interesting questions about social media and its role in learning. And then stepped into an administrative job for 3 years. But after that, pretty much made the decision to go out on my own and write and speak and consult with schools. And so that's what I've been doing now for, I can't believe it, but it's almost 9 years. It's been a long time since I've been in a system.
Is there a big story behind leaving your administrative role in the school, or were you just tired?
No, I wasn't tired. I loved my job, but I really, my brain wasn't at my job, and that was the problem. I was, you know, really engaged in a lot of conversations online around the future of education and learning. I started speaking at conferences, and it got to the point where I just had to make a decision, because I was using just about every vacation day to go out and you know, speak somewhere or work somewhere with some teachers. And you know, I just realized that as much as I love being in a school, I had a real passion for this work as well, and just decided to make that step. And you know, I'm glad I did. I mean, I miss kids. You know, I'd love to be at some point get back in a classroom with kids and work with them. But this has been really interesting work over the last, like I said, 9 years. It's just a fascinating time to kind of be able to step back from it all and try to see it a little bit more, with a little bit more of a meta perspective, if you know what I mean. I certainly talk to a lot of teachers on a regular basis, and I know that in many cases, teaching these days is kind of an onerous job, given all the kind of external requirements and assessments and evaluations and expectations and things like that. But I still look at it from a learning context and just can't imagine there's been a better time to be a learner. And that's really what keeps me motivated.
Will, how have your views on teaching and learning changed between your first day in the classroom and, let's say, that last day as an administrator? And I think these are two separate questions, your views on teaching and your views on learning.
Well, I think that they both changed a lot. I'm not sure that they changed radically on the, you know, from the time I started in the school system to the time I left. But again, over the last, you know, few years that I've been doing this work, they changed almost 100%. I mean, I think that teaching is still a really, really important role, a really important profession, and that, you know, kids need teachers. And I want my kids with teachers. I say that all the time, and I really mean that. But I think that the role of teaching has just totally changed when you've got a world where all of the knowledge, all of the curriculum is basically, you know, a couple clicks away. Our role, or teacher's role, becomes not so much to kind of deliver it or to meet it out in terms of the curriculum, but to help kids create their own curriculum, find their own classrooms, you know, create their own path to whatever it is that they want to learn. And I think, you know, from a learning context, I think we're going back. I think eventually, I don't know how quickly it's going to be, but I think we're going back to a time where we saw learning in a different way. I love the quote, Seymour Papert, that goes something like, you know, all of us have this one side of the brain that thinks school is the most natural way to learn, and then we have the other side of the brain which knows that it's absolutely not. You know, we know in our own personal practice that we don't learn in the same ways that we learn in school. And I think there's this, I've been writing a lot about this freedom to learn that we now find ourselves with the web and these technologies, that is going to, I think, force schools, if they're going to remain at all relevant, to create cultures and create conditions where learning is the center of the work, not teaching. And I think, again, I mean, no disrespect to teachers at all, but I think the reality of the world is now that we have to be learners first. We have to focus on learning first. And I think too often schools are still teaching cultures. And I think that that's going to be a problem moving forward.
Will, in the book Why School, you begin with this wonderful story about your 13-year-old son when he discovers Minecraft, and that's the ultra popular computer game, and he quickly teaches himself everything he needs to know about Minecraft, and you, as a parental authority on technology, quickly become irrelevant. And so my question is, what is it about Minecraft that has this power and appeal to so many young people, and is it representative of this greater shift in teaching and learning?
Well, I think Minecraft's appeal is that it's constructivist, and that it's also highly collaborative, where kids can work with one another to build things in Minecraft. They can teach one another. My son, when he started playing, was in a Minecraft server that was being housed in Australia. And so were there all sorts of kids who were in there from around the world. I think it's challenging enough so that kids remain engaged, and yet they're motivated to just build things, to build really interesting, whether those are houses or to mine for certain, you know, certain ores or whatever else. I think that the other piece that's interesting about Minecraft is that it was released into the world without any instruction manual. Mojang said, basically, here's this really interesting program, figure it out. And so everything that you see around Minecraft, whether it's on YouTube or anywhere else, was all user created. Nothing of that stuff was created by anyone who created the game itself. I think Minecraft reflects a lot of the potential of learning in the real world now. Because again, it gives kids the ability to connect to other kids, other people who share a passion or an interest for whatever it is they're learning about. They can make things, videos. I mean, in the real world or in the virtual world, they make videos and, you know, Instagram, Snapchat. I mean, all of those tools, even though some of the things that they create may not be highly complex, they're still creating and sharing on a regular basis, and it's a kind of a mindset and a culture that goes along with that. So I've read a couple things where people say Minecraft may be the most interesting learning tool of the 21st century thus far, and I would tend to agree that we can learn a lot from what our kids are doing in that space, and it wouldn't be a bad idea to try to figure out how to make our classrooms a little more similar to Minecraft than they are.
I like that. That's a good concept for a school startup. I played a lot of computer and video games as a kid, and what struck me when somebody showed me Minecraft is that it was not obviously goal-oriented.
Right.
there was no clear, it wasn't like playing a Final Fantasy role-playing game where you're going through the different levels and you're trying to defeat the boss. It's just, here's this world, you know, go dig something, go make something. And then kids make these ridiculous, you know, replicas of the Star Wars Millennium Falcon or, you know, elaborate worlds. And but there's nothing there guiding them and pointing them in that direction.
Well, I think it's interesting. You don't win, you know, in Minecraft. There's no winner. So what you're trying to do is learn how to get the stuff that you need to build the stuff that you want to build, you know, and that's the motivation. You're not getting a grade. There's no rubric. You know, it's not, I sometimes think about what Minecraft might look like in school, you know, the Minecraft textbook, read chapter one, do problem number one, make a tree. Here's the rubric. You know, it's like, it's totally dissimilar, obviously. And, I don't know. I think again that the key to me, I mean, there's self-directed learning, obviously, which I know you talk a lot about and a lot of people talk about and write about. And I think that term does a pretty good job of capturing what's possible now. But I like the term self-organized as well, because to me, that's the role that school takes in my kids' lives. They organize it all. I think it's, are kids going to be responsible for organizing their own learning? They're going to have to figure out, again, you know, how to find those resources, how to find those teachers. It's not just going to be so much pursuing the things that they have an interest in. They're going to have those kind of skills and literacies and dispositions that allow them to create learning environments on their own. So Minecraft is a way to do that, and I think it's a kind of an interesting first step, but certainly that constructivist aspect of Minecraft then being used kind of in real world learning, you know, that maybe doesn't have that type of environment built into it. I think, you know, that's where kids need to get to, and that's where we need to help kids get to, and we need to help them do that really well.
So let's stay on that theme. And in your book, you write, quote, "We aren't suddenly self-directed, organized, and literate enough to make sense of all the people and information online, or savvy enough to connect and build relationships with others in safe, ethical, and effective ways." And then you go on to argue that this is what we need to help kids do nowadays, is to figure out how to self-organize and how to separate the good from the bad online, because there's so much out there. And my question is, do you have any concrete examples of what this looks like to help kids do this sort of self-directed learning using online resources?
I mean, first of all, I think that kids are doing a lot of this on their own and, you know, without us. Again, my own kids' pursuits of the things that they really are interested in is happening pretty much without the aegis of school. I'm not sure their school is actually teaching them much, if anything, around how to do it well, because even the literacies that they're taught in school have a decidedly, you know, analog kind of application. And I think that the digital and online applications are much, much more complex. They build on those same types of literacies, but there are nuances that I think are difficult for all of us even to kind of figure out. You know, we struggle with what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. You can see this happening all the time in the adult world online, you know, with grownups. And then so when kids are trying to figure it out, I think, right now they're doing it without a lot of models, without a lot of people who are standing over their shoulders saying, yeah, well, think about that. So what are the ramifications of this and how might you find a better source and those types of things? I'm not sure that schools are, like I said, I'm not sure schools are doing it really well, but I do think that there are a number of concrete examples, a number of schools that have embraced that type of pedagogy, if you will. And, that have put digital tools in the hands of learners and given them the agency to use those tools to learn around the things that they care about. And in the process of doing that, then been, you know, that person next to them, giving them advice, giving them feedback, asking them questions. As my friend Gary Steger says, you know, throwing a well-designed problem in their way when they need it, you know, to figure something out. And that doesn't happen very often, but it is beginning to happen, I think, in more and more places, and certainly in lots of classrooms, as you can see many teachers who are sharing their classroom contexts on Twitter or in blog posts and writing about those types of environments where kids are again getting more agent or being given more agency and autonomy over their learning, and that the role of the teacher in the classroom becomes as more of a laboratory for that. You know, how do we do that well, rather than a place where there's a predefined, preset curriculum to deliver around that.
What are a few of those schools that you're a fan of? I know you write about High Tech High in San Diego in your book.
I mean, High Tech High, Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia certainly is one. Mount Vernon Presbyterian, which is an independent school outside of Atlanta. The Castleview High School, which is doing in Colorado near you, which is doing a very interesting kind of pullout program called the Mosaic School, school within a school where kids are pursuing their own learning. I mean, really, again, being given agency and autonomy to learn in those ways. And there, like I said, there are lots of classrooms, lots of individual teachers. So finding schools, the interesting thing about the Castleview School is that it's one of the few that hasn't been built for that. You know, most of those other examples like High Tech High and Science Leadership Academy and others, those schools were constructed with this type of learning in mind. So I think it's really difficult for traditional schools to turn the way that they think about learning in the classroom to give kids more ownership over their learning because those traditional narratives run really, really deep. And it's just a totally different culture that you need to create in order for that stuff to happen well.
What would you do if you went back into the classroom and you as an educator had the freedom to run the show just how you wanted? What content would you teach? And then what would your methods be?
Well, that's an interesting thing that you say too, because it's not just freedom to learn, it's freedom to teach too. I mean, I think that's a big piece of it. If schools are going to adjust, if schools are going to stay relevant, if they really are going to prepare kids for the world that they're going to live in, I think, again, we're going to go back and we're going to have to redefine and re-envision what it means to be a teacher, and teachers need agency as well. Right now, there's, you know, I go to too many places where everybody's reading the same PowerPoint on the same day or reading off of index cards on the same day. So, I mean, if I got to go back in the classroom, I would try as hard as I could to simply, as Albert Einstein famously says, you know, create the conditions under which kids can learn. And, you know, those conditions require an interest, relevance, passion, agency. Feedback and mentoring and teaching is a big part of that, obviously, but certainly it's more about kids organizing it, kids choosing what it is that they want to learn. And in that Mosaic School example that I just gave you, I mean, that's wide open for kids. They can learn, they can pursue whatever they want. There are no subjects, there are no disciplines, no grades. I mean, it is about as open as you can imagine, actually. But, you know, in most schools where, you know, you're still going to be teaching in an English class or a math class, I still think that there are ways to go into that and say, well, you know, here are the things that the state is requiring us to learn, or the district or whatever else. How do we want to get there? You know, I think if teachers can create, again, an environment or a culture within the classroom that gives kids the sense that they can really pursue what they're interested in, then the teacher's role becomes, how do you connect those passions and those interests to the traditional outcomes or to the outcomes that the state wants to wants kids to have? And those two things aren't mutually exclusive, by the way, but certainly since we've been doing it for 150 years, there is a well-worn path to quote-unquote success in those
Definitely.
In those ways that makes it difficult, I think, for teachers to think about doing it in a different way.
So what I'm hearing, Will, is that if you could run your own show, this is sounding a lot like a free school, or kind of like almost an unschooling center, because you're letting kids have total agency about what they choose to study. And it sounds like you're positioning yourself as a mentor, a supporter, you know, maybe you could think about this problem a different way type guys. Is that accurate or no?
Yeah, I don't know that I'd go totally to the unschool piece of it, because I think we're going to have to, and I'm going to have to live under certain realities that make that difficult to do, you know, in a quote unquote school space in that type of environment. I think it's easier to do that unschooling thing at home. And I know that there are certain places like Sudbury Schools and others, that Summerhill and, you know, others that get pretty close to that, actually. And I know that those kids go to college. I know everyone's shocked when they hear that, but the kids who go to those schools and who pretty much pursue the things that they really care about without a lot of organization, if any organization from the adults, you know, they still do really well. So I don't know that I'd be quite that far to that side of it, but certainly I would be creating, trying to create many more conditions, much different cultures in my school that would allow teachers and students the freedom to, you know, go down those paths that interest them and yet connect to, I think, some of the very valid things that we want kids to be able to do, that we want kids to be able to know. I kind of agree with David Perkins and Roger Shank and others that the scope of the curriculum now is just ridiculous. There's way too much stuff that I think we're requiring kids to know. David Perkins says that 90% of the current curriculum is kind of irrelevant. And I would tend to get close to that. But I still think there is some core, and I use that word very carefully, but
yeah.
You know, there's some foundational knowledge that I think we need to address in schools. So I'm probably somewhere in the middle, if somewhere toward that end, but not quite all the way there.
Well, let's keep going with the Will Richardson school thought experiment here.
Okay.
And because I was really interested in something you wrote about assessment and testing, and you summarized it well in this one sentence: stop asking questions on tests that can be answered by a Google search. And that just... I'm a big fan of the website Let Me Google That For You, and using that in a kind of snarky way to send links to friends when they ask me questions they should have Googled themselves.
Right.
So if you were going to have assessment or testing in your mythological school, then is this the principle you would operate on? Like, only ask really good questions that can't be Googled?
I think that in terms of the important parts of what we do, in terms of what we want to know that kids can do, we need to ask those types of questions and see how kids deal with those types of questions. I think it's ridiculous. I'm a big fan of open phone tests at this point. Why wouldn't we let our kids bring their phones into exams? You know, that's the way they're going to answer all those types of questions when they're not in school. So we should be assessing whether or not they can use their phones to answer the questions that we're asking them. I think that's probably the more important piece of it than those, you know, particular answers themselves. But look, it's how do we assess the work that we do as adults? I mean, how do we assess all of the things that don't get a grade in our lives? The only times we're graded is in school. So I think we can learn a lot from the ways that we assess outside of school. We assess by performance. We assess by how motivated people are and how collaborative they are in solving difficult problems, if they have patience to do that. If we assess people by how curious they are to find problems to solve and to look for gaps that may exist and figure out ways of closing those gaps. So, you know, I think that we have this obsession with only assessing those things that are easily quantifiable. And I think that that's a huge problem. You know, there's a quote that I used where it's basically, you know, if we don't assess the things that we value, you know, like creativity and curiosity and whether or not kids can work with one another and if they're patient problem solvers and all those types of things, if we don't assess those things, then we're going to end up valuing the things that we assess. And that's pretty much the state of education in the United States today. We value those things that are easy to measure. And more and more as we move forward, those things that are easy to measure are less and less important. It's the stuff that's hard to measure, the immeasurable things that are vastly more important today than knowing the dates of the Civil War or being able to, crank out some formula to solve some contrived problem on a math examination somewhere.
I'm so with you, Will, and I'm still wondering, what does school look like when we start to prioritize these personal characteristics, like curiosity, like the ability to ask a smart question, instead of things that are easily measurable on tests?
Well, it's chaos. No, I mean, in some ways, it's chaos, you know, and it that's what I think makes it so scary for people, is because that type of a school requires us to give up control. Right now, we want to control, whether we say it or not in education, we want to control just about every piece of it. We want to control when kids eat lunch. We want to control whether or not they can use their phones. We want to control what they wear. You know, all those things, all those rules that we have. The reason that we have all those rules is because if we are going to educate every child in the traditional sense, it has to be efficient and organized. You have to have desks in rows, pretty much. You know, you have to have a lesson plan. Everybody's got to be articulating, you know, what comes up next, and what, how does that match up with the next course or whatever else. To all of a sudden say we're not going to organize it, well, you're going to get it's going to look like chaos. But the key is to understand that learning is chaotic. You know, Brian Crosby, one of my favorite teachers, you know, his blog, his name is Learning is Messy, and it is. It's not linear. It's not everybody doing the same thing on the same day. So, again, I think that the biggest piece of that is developing a culture, or not even developing, but allowing for a culture that embraces a certain amount of chaos, a certain amount of uncertainty, a certain amount of not getting to the answer. Because so much of the work that we do when we learn, we never really do get to an answer. I mean, I've been asking this same question now for 9 years. Which is driving my professional learning. I'm not even close to getting to an answer, but yet I'm still motivated. I'm still motivated to learn about it. I'm still motivated to engage in these types of conversations because I keep thinking it's going to change, and we need to figure out what that change is going to look like. So, it's not going to look like the traditional school, but yet I think there's huge value in a school space where kids come together with adults to grapple with those types of questions and to make sense of the chaos that goes on with learning.
I agree, and that's reflected in my work with teenagers who don't go to school. They still crave, they still hunger for meaningful and quality adult contact, mm-hmm. adults who are not their parents, adults who can really say, like, listen, you're not framing this problem correctly. Like, go back, read this, come back to me once you've figured it out. Mm-hmm. You can give sort of no BS feedback. If you put enough of those together, then, and you want to call it a school, I say go for it. Mm-hmm. Here's a question about technology and about humans. What is it that human educators can do that you think digital technologies can't do right now and probably will never be able to do? What is the special sauce that a physical human presence has that we'll never be able to replace?
Well, I think the obvious one is that I think only humans can care for one another in ways that, in an education sense at least, support the types of learning that we're talking about. I mean, no computer is going to help to make sure that a kid is fed, is dressed, you know, has heat. There's a certain element of education and schooling, and it's bigger than just schooling and education. Obviously, it's a societal element that we need to care for kids. And I can't see a day when technologies can match the ethic of care that humans can display and that humans can put forth for the kids who are in their charge. So that's a big part of it. And again, I think that it's about a human's ability to create a culture where kids feel safe, where kids feel valued, where kids are motivated and inspired to really think or to create in ways that maybe they never thought they could think or create before. I'm not convinced that technology can do that solely. I absolutely believe there are times when technology can do that. I think you're seeing that in gaming environments now, where there are some pretty powerful motivators and some pretty powerful learning environments within games that I think kids are inspired by and can learn deeply from. But at the end of the day, I just believe that there has to be some human context, some human touch, if you know what I mean, that that kids can grasp onto, and that they feel that not only are they safe, but that the work that they're doing and the learning that they're doing has relevance and meaning beyond just what's happening in a classroom.
There's not an app for that? There's not a meaning and relevance app?
No, not yet.
Someone should build that.
I don't think they'll be able to build that one.
What about the warm, comforting presence app?
Well, you know, they have those robots now that you can curl up in their laps and stuff. I don't think that...
The classroom of the future.
Yeah, I just don't think that that's going to happen. It's not going to happen, I don't think, in my lifetime. And I think I'd be really sad to see that happen, actually, you know, because that would mean that we have moved into a very, very kind of different world at that point.
Are you familiar with Audrey Waters, who writes the blog Hack Education?
Absolutely. Audrey and I are collaborators on modernlearners.com. So
does not surprise me. So I've seen that she's writing a book about the history of the future of education.
Yeah.
And recently had a wonderful blog post up with these illustrations from magazines from going back to the turn of the century, that had these proposed teaching machines that would, you know, the best one was the kids had the caps on their head and the professor or the teacher was dumping in books of like the history of France into this machine that a kid was cranking and the wires went over to the kid's head.
Right.
And so are you saying that you think this dream that a lot of people who are in the educational technology space right now have of creating something, some machine, some technology that will essentially relieve us of the burden of teaching? Do you think that's a false dream?
Well, it depends on how you define teaching, right? I mean, if you define teaching as delivering a curriculum, a fairly discrete curriculum that's primarily testable and accessible by some type of, you know, either short answer or multiple choice or whatever type of test, I don't have any doubts that technology can probably get us to pass those tests better than humans can. If you sit down and you take an adaptive math, let's say an adaptive algebra program, again, if the goal is to pass the algebra test, I wouldn't doubt that technology can get you to pass that test better than a teacher can. But that's the problem, right? The goal shouldn't be to pass the test. The goal should be to be able to apply algebra in real life situations as needed and in ways that are relevant and make sense. My son in Minecraft is applying algebra for a real purpose. I mean, he's in geometry and all sorts of other stuff that he probably doesn't even realize it's algebra and geometry, but he's working that stuff out. But he has a reason to do that. You know, it's not just because he's going to take some exam at the end of it. So, you know, again, we have a problem, I think. One of the biggest problems we have, I think, is that we don't all agree on what it means to learn, you know, how to define learning. When you go to a lot of schools and they say, Wes, we want to improve student learning, I think that the way they're defining that could probably be done better with technology than with people. But then you go to other schools, you go to other places where they talk about learning in a much, much different way, in a much different context, where it is about exploration, it's about creation, it's about connecting with other people to do real meaningful work in the world. And that's why I don't think technology can take the place of a teacher.
Will, you're a big fan, as I am, of asking young people to create actual work and actual, I call them digital artifacts, as a way of demonstrating what they've learned. So write a blog post, create a video, create a social media account, and publish it online and make it discoverable by strangers. And I know that you've shared these ideas with a lot of teachers, a lot of educators. And have you received any pushback on that when you say, you know, don't just give them a homework assignment that only two people will ever see. Put something up on the internet.
Oh, sure. I mean, there are a lot of people who fear putting students out there online and you know, I have some real concerns about, and they should. I mean, we should have concerns when we put kids' work up online. But I don't think that we, I think a lot of those concerns are basically, or come out of the fact that most of those teachers aren't putting work up online. They don't have experience with it. They don't have a practice around it. Most of, if not all, of the really great examples of kids doing interesting, meaningful, important work online comes from classrooms where the teachers are also doing meaningful, interesting, important work online. So the more that you have a practice around it, the more you have a context around it, I think the more that you're willing to let kids do that and to encourage kids to do that in ways that are, again, safe and ethical, and to make those two things and kind of a priority of the conversations around the work that they do as well.
When I try to get teenagers to put things online, I receive a lot of resistance. And this is from, you know, the most savvy digital native teenagers out there. And they seem to be afraid of what people will think about them. But then they also seem to lack the technical skills, they feel, to write a respectable blog post or make a video that people would actually want to watch. Have you experienced the same thing? And if so, how have you helped teenagers, or I'm sorry, students of any age, get over these blocks?
Well, I mean, I look at my own two kids, my own two teenagers, and I know that they're creating a lot of things, a lot of artifacts, and putting them up online regularly. Whether those are, again, like I said, Instagram pictures, Snapchats, tweets, in some cases, blog posts, videos. I think that the problem comes when we begin to ask them, you know, let's make a Shakespeare video. if they don't really care about Shakespeare, they're not going to care about making a Shakespeare video either. Now, having said that, I think that there is some, again, a culture piece of this that for most kids who go to school, they very quickly get the idea that the only work that really counts is the work that gets handed in to the teacher, that gets graded. And to try to convince the kid to do real work for real purposes, for real audiences, without making it feel contrived in the context of, you know, this very kind of organized classroom that most kids are in, I think it's difficult. So, again, I go back to this whole culture piece. If you want kids to do really great things online, you have to create a culture that says that that's valued, that that's something that's really important, and that that's a part of the natural work that we do in schools. We don't just do stuff that hangs up on a classroom wall somewhere or out in the hallway somewhere. We do stuff beginning in first grade that has you know, answers real questions, that attempts to solve real problems, or at least contributes to the knowledge base, creates new knowledge, and shares that knowledge in some way. So it's not surprising when you have a lot of kids who don't feel comfortable creating or sharing work that they do in the classroom. That hasn't been the expectation, and they're not sure what that, you know, what that means. Outside of classrooms, I don't think they worry about it as much.
They just post whatever comes to their mind on.
Well, yeah, but you know what? I think that we're all I won't speak for everyone. I had a tendency, I think, to see teenagers especially as not thinking about what they did with the stuff that they posted online. I think they think a lot more than we think, that we think they do. They make mistakes, certainly. My kids have made mistakes. Luckily, none of them have been catastrophic, but it's certainly, you know, they are trying. They're trying things out as they post. But they're fairly thoughtful about it. Most kids are. And they develop their own kinds of literacies around that without us. And, you know, all the research shows that kids actually keep themselves fairly safe even without us. You know, we don't give them much chance not to be safe in classrooms because we block it, filter it, we tell them they can't go online or whatever else. that even outside of classrooms, they do a fairly good job of not putting themselves into positions where they can, you know, be bullied or harmed or whatever else. So I think that I think we still can play a big role in helping them do that even better, though.
What are your kids' relationship to school? Are they saying why school?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like?
It's hard. I mean, you know, they go to my old school, and my daughter's going to graduate in June. She can't wait.
Is that a public school?
Yeah, it's a public high school. Okay. In New Jersey. My son, who's a sophomore, it's deadly right now. But he's at the age where all the surveys show is the worst level of engagement in school. One of the surveys I was just writing about it this morning actually showed 37% of sophomores are engaged in school. So, you know, it's really hard right now. If it wasn't for sports, if it wasn't for their friends, I think it'd be even worse. But academically, they're not engaged. And I'm not throwing teachers under the bus here. I think teachers are trying to do as good a job as they can. But, you know, at the end of the day, if kids don't care about the stuff that you're trying to teach, it's not going to matter what you do. You can, you know, stand on your head metaphorically and try to get kids connected to whatever the curriculum is. But it's not going to happen if there's no sense of agency, if there's no culture that says to kids, you can learn whatever you want to learn within the context of this particular classroom.
Last question, Will. As an advocate for technologies, for social media, what is your own policy with your own kids about technology and screen time?
Well, when they were younger, we definitely put limits on it. Their internet connections went down at 9 o'clock every night. You know, no phones in their bedrooms, things like that. As they've grown older, we've kind of loosened up on that a little bit. Because, look, I mean, the reality of it is that my kids connect to their peers, to their friends, through the technologies that are in their pockets. And as much as my wife and I are always kind of on the lookout to make sure that there's a balance, and we do have certainly some rules around that, you know, no phones at dinner and things like that, kind of your typical ones. I fully understand that those technologies are important things in their lives, and that it's not a bad thing necessarily for them to be connected to their friends, you know, texting and things like that, as long as there is some balance to it. So we're constantly encouraging our kids and helping our kids get outside, play basketball, walk around, you know, bike, go to the gym, read books, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, like I said, as they've gotten older, I think we've kind of loosened the grip on that a little bit, because they're going to have to make some decisions, and they're going to have to figure out where their balance is at some point by themselves. We're not going to be around to mediate that for them much longer. So hopefully they can figure it out while they're still here. And we can counsel and kind of mentor them on that.
My guest today has been Will Richardson. Will, thanks for being a guest.
My pleasure, Blake.
This is the Real Education Podcast. This show is produced with the assistance of Zen Zenith, who also created the music. For more episodes, visit blakebowles.com/podcast. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.